You're listening to On the Point, the News Collective's weekly report, formerly known as Democracy Watch, bringing you alternative and undercover current affairs from the Vancouver and Lower Mainland. I'm Zachary Tharp.
I'm Akshay Kulkarni.
I'm Adeline Ping.
And I'm Isa Yu.
It's Thursday, January 23rd at 5:05 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC Vancouver's UBC Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
So we have a packed show for you today. We are going to be talking about the upcoming protests at the Indian Consulate, the Muslim Students Association here at UBC, and the funeral industry. But first, Chinese New Year's is coming up, and we have some local Chinese-Canadian history. So let's take a listen.
This is my first time, and I'm really excited.
Okay, well, welcome.
Thank you.
Come on in.
So do you mind, first of all, like, pronouncing your name?
My name is Christina Laszlo, and I am the archivist here at Rare Books and Special Collections at the UBC Library, and I'm the person responsible for the Chung Collection.
So could you give me, like, an idea of, like, what is the Chung Collection, first of all?
Of course. Okay, so the Chung Collection was donated to us about 20 years ago by Dr. Wallace Chung and his wife Madeline Chung. And Dr. Chung, Wallace Chung, had been collecting since he was actually a small child. So this is about 60 or so years of collecting. And he became very interested in the Canadian Pacific Railway Company. His mother had come over from China on the Empress of Asia. And he had grown up looking at a poster of this ship in his father's tailor shop in Victoria, and he was always fascinated by the Canadian Pacific Railway and the ships that brought people across the ocean to Canada. So he started collecting, and then eventually his collecting branched out to also cover not just the Canadian Pacific Railway Company, but early exploration in British Columbia, and also immigration and settlement, and particularly immigration and settlement of the Chinese diaspora. So after collecting for many, many decades, Dr. Chung wanted to donate the collection to University of British Columbia, partly because he wanted people to be able to look at and learn from this material. So what you see here today in the Chung Collection exhibit area is just a small part of that collection.
So do you mind, you know, giving me a tour?
Yeah, no, I'm happy to give you a tour of the collection. It's a really amazing collection. So what you see here on exhibit is actually just a small portion of the entire thing. Most of it is available for research and consultation in the reference room, and there's an online website students can go to and researchers can go to look up all the material that we have available, and it's huge. There's something like 25,000 items in the collection, and which includes archival materials, photographs, ledgers, documents, as well as rare books, and all about the exploration of British Columbia, the archives and papers of prominent individuals in the Chinese community who helped build Vancouver, helped build British Columbia, information about the railway company, the gold rush, and also maps of early explorers to this part of the world, dating all the way back to the late 1700s. So we have maps from some of those early Spanish explorers as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a lot. Yeah, there's a lot here. So we usually start the tour with basically just explaining how Dr. Chung started collecting. So this photograph here, I mean, you can't see it if you're listening to me talk, but there's a photograph at the very start of the exhibit that shows Dr. Chung's father's and in his tailor shop. And over in the top corner, you see the ship that inspired Dr. Chung. So he grew up looking at this poster. So it's a really nice way to start the exhibit because it really shows what the inspiration for Dr. Chung. And he also really wanted to collect this material partly because of his own roots, but at the time that he started collecting Canadian Pacific Railway Company materials, it wasn't as popular of a collection, so he really was able to acquire a lot of materials that would be much difficult to find nowadays. Also, he was interested in documenting his roots and the roots of his community, so a lot of the materials that he has on the Chinese community in BC and Canada, again, would be difficult to find now because more people are now interested in collecting that type of material, but when Dr. Chung was looking at it, it was easier to find, and he was able to collect a really, really cohesive and detailed story about the Chinese community in Vancouver and how this community helped to build this province and their role in the New World, as much as, if not more important, than the role of Europeans in this part of the world.
Mm-hmm. So personally, I'm really interested in the Chinese-Canadian aspect of it, just because I am like Chinese-Canadian. Mm-hmm. And so if we're walking through, if you could point out like the specific things that really highlight the Chinese-Canadian like artifacts or whatnot, or like the experience, that'd be great. Thank
definitely.
You.
So I'm not sure where to start. Mm-hmm. But certainly I think the early days of the first Chinese that came to this part of the world was probably as part of the Gold Rush. And they set up businesses to help not only to support the gold rush, but also participate in it as well. So we have things like this gold pan that I think Dr. Chung, I'm not sure where he found this. If you're lucky enough to have him give a tour of this collection, he has stories for most of these objects. But the gold rush is really where it started, and then moved on to the railway company. As most people that have studied Canadian history know, or British Columbia history, that getting the railway to connect the eastern part of Canada with the west coast was one of the conditions of Confederation for British Columbia to enter into the Confederation of Canada, and the only way that they could meet this deadline was to hire labor from Chinese labor that they would pay less and worked under very harsh conditions, and many people were physically injured or lost their lives as part of this process. So there's a lot of material here that tells that story of Chinese labor on the Canadian Pacific Railway and how that railway would not have been completed without that help. So if we go over to the section that has a small bit on the railway, which is here. So this exhibit case really highlights how dangerous the work was to build the railway, especially through British Columbia, which has many mountain ranges. So there was lots of blasting that needed to be done. And finally, the last spike of the railway was done in Craigellachie, which is in the Rocky Mountains, I believe. And it's interesting, so you see this photograph on display here, which shows the last spike of the railway being hammered in. And what's interesting about this photo is who's not in the picture. So you see what you see here is a lot of European men in suits, probably all the railway bigwigs who are here, who really did not do much labor. Mm-hmm. What you don't see in the photo is any person of Chinese cultural background, which is interesting because without them, the railway would not have been built. So it's interesting how people revise history to leave out a lot of contribution. So this collection is also really important in that it brings that contribution and that history back into the foreground rather than it being ignored in what would in the past would have been a common story of the triumph of business and getting this railway done and completed in time for Confederation. In the past, glossing over the contribution of Chinese labor to getting that done.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one aspect here. And I can show you my favorite, my absolute favorite photo in this collection is this on the wall here. So what we're looking at is a photograph of the Chinese Students Football Club of Vancouver, and they won the 1926 Iroquois Cup. So by football here, I mean soccer. So this is the soccer team. And what I really love about this story is that the soccer or football teams in Vancouver at that time in the 1920s were not integrated. So the Chinese players were not allowed or discouraged from playing on the teams of players from European descent, but they were so good that they won the Iroquois Cup, which was an intercity cup at that point in time. So this photograph shows the football team with the cup. And what I love about this is that they triumphed again in the face of racism and in the face of exclusion, that they came back and beat the other teams. And it's a really great photo. It sort of covers, it's about, oh, I don't know, about 2 feet by 3 feet wide. It's a great photograph, and it shows the team in all their glory. So I really like this one, not just because I'm a football fan, but because I love the story of them beating the other people at their own game.
Yeah, it's like, even though I've lived in Vancouver mm-hmm. for a long time, I haven't really been able to see, like, a lot of evidence of the Chinese contribution. Yeah. And so, like, it's nice to have this collection here.
Well, that's exactly it, because it, you know, in building and talking about the history of British Columbia and talking about the history of Vancouver and the history of Canada, it's important that all the contribution of all the different communities that helped build this province is included in the historical narrative. And in the past, that narrative has been, I don't know if controlled is the right word, but definitely the dominant view has been the European view, one of conquering the land, of creating opportunity and business. And it hasn't included the contribution of all of the other communities that have also participated in building this province. And not just the Chinese community, but the South Asian community and all the other communities that have come to this part of the world looking to build a new life, just as the European people were here looking to build a new life. And that desire and that dream isn't exclusive to one community. It's something that we all share. Most of us are immigrants to this land, whether it's Europeans, and we're all settlers here for the most part. So everybody's story is relevant and important, and this collection definitely does a lot to help bring the Chinese part of the story to the foreground.
Okay. Anywhere else?
Well, this case here is talking about the Yip Sang family, who was a prominent family in Chinatown. So it just shows that people were here and they were successful in business and they were building communities. So this display case shows beautiful china and flatware and silverware from one of the Empress ships that was on the route between Hong Kong, China, and the Pacific Coast and Vancouver. And what's interesting about this is when you look at it, you just see china and plates and dishes and things and menus. But what's interesting about this is how Dr. Chung, how the plates specifically came to be in this collection. So the story goes that the people who worked on the ship, especially in the kitchen, were largely Chinese labor again. And on going back and forth, at the end of the shift, if people were tired, it was a long shift, that the dishes would come back, and rather than washing them, people would throw them overboard. So the idea here is that, or what I've been told once, that if you were to drain the Pacific Ocean, you would find a trail of CPR china from Vancouver to Hong Kong because of all the things that had been thrown overboard. So many of these plates were actually brought up from the bottom of the ocean by divers who found them. And at first they were wondering, they thought they were just broken crockery and things. But as they started pulling them out, they realized that they were full plates. So Dr. Chung acquired, I think, 30 or 40 plates from this diver who had brought them all up from the ocean floor as part of this. So it's a great story, especially just because it's like, you can imagine at the end of a long shift and washing dishes, you're just, you know, I don't want to have to wash this. So overboard they went. But it's also interesting because on those Empress of Asia ships, it was, you know, Chinese labor who worked on the ships, but it's also a lot of people moving back and forth between Hong Kong, China, and Vancouver in terms of getting to this new world. As I mentioned at the start, Dr. Chung's mother came on one of the Empress of Asia ships. So it was the CPR was really important in that story of movement between Asia and North America, because most of those communities treaties came across the Pacific Ocean, whereas all the Europeans came across the Atlantic. So the idea of the Pacific as a place of the Trans-Pacific story is just as important as the Trans-Atlantic stories as well. But this story of the dishes is just one of the funny, quirky ones that I love, partly because I can picture myself doing something exactly like that, is at the end of the shift, just heaving the dishes, dirty dishes, overboard.
Do you have any other collections that you want to show me?
You're looking at specifically the Chinese-Canadian experience. What's also interesting is, what's really beautiful to look at as well, is all of these old CPR posters, because the 1920s is really a time when tourism, the idea of people being able to have leisure time and money and travel, was more easy. So the CPR really promoted travel to everywhere, every community that they served. So there's these beautiful old posters from the 1920s and the 1930s that are promoting tourism and travel to all of the destinations that the CPR network reached. So they're just, the design is beautiful, the colors are beautiful. So just as objects of art and aesthetics, they're really quite amazing to look at. We have hundreds of posters, CPR posters, in our collection, and on display we have just a small, small percentage of those posters.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed one of them says, to the Far East, Japan, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And so would this have been, like, white people going, like...
Yeah, yeah. I think there's definitely a number of different classes that traveled on the ship. So we had, you had people traveling back and forth across the Pacific to visit family, but there was also the idea of tourism, generally of European people traveling to Asia, and it was very much exoticized, like it was an mm-hmm. exotic destination. And if you look at the posters, people are dressed up in traditional clothing that... don't think people were necessarily dressing like that at this time. People were, I think, dressing more in sort of a modern way. But it's very much a romanticization of what Asia, quote unquote, was like back in the 1920s, and definitely still a lot of racism and racial stereotypes in the depiction, how people were predicted. And even when you look at some of the journals and correspondence and materials in the Chung collection around those travels, the descriptions are very much from a Eurocentric perspective, and still talking about the Chinese cities they're visiting, or the communities, the people that they're encountering, in a very much a way that wouldn't be appropriate to talk mm-hmm. about people these days. But in the 1920s, there was still there's a lot of racism today, but in the 1920s, even more so. So you get a lot of that in the descriptions of people traveling, of Europeans traveling to that part of the world.
Mm-hmm. I'm really also interested in the, like, story of Chinese resistance, or just like being a minority, or being like being able to find a community in this new and foreign place against all odds. Like, I think that's a really interesting narrative. Are there any other pieces in the collection that kind of display that?
Yeah, there's not anything on display per se, but in the materials that are not on display but are accessible for researchers, there's a lot of material that tells a story of that, and I don't see it. When Dr. Chung talks about it, he talks about it as a period of triumph in the face of adversity, and he talks a lot about how, despite a lot of challenges, how the Chinese community triumphed. And how they weren't given a lot of breaks, yet they persevered. And so he really talks about it as a process of triumph and celebration, in sense of what's been achieved in this province. And he really points to the time in the late 1940s when the vote was extended to the Chinese community. And I think it was 1949, but I'm not 100% certain. 48, 49, something like that. And that was really, once the Chinese community was given the franchise, that real equality was able to happen, when they had a voice and power in how to repeal the Exclusion Act. And things, sort of one thing happened after the other. And, being able to be part of the community, to be to be own businesses, to participate, to go to university, to get an education. So he really looks at the progression of what it was like in the during the railway, during the time when the railway was being built, to now where there's so much success within the community here in Vancouver, Chinese community in Vancouver.
Where could I find these pieces if I was personally interested in looking
okay.
at them?
Okay. So if you go onto the Rare Books and Special Collections website, there's a link there to the Chung Collection, and you can search the Chung Collection there. You can, I think there's, like I said, there's over 25,000 items, so you can search material there.
Earlier we walked past a display case with immigration papers. I was wondering, is there anything related to the head tax
there? Yes. Yeah, we do have a number of head tax certificates in the collection as well. Some of them are on display, and I'm just trying to think where they are in this collection. But there's a lot of material on the head tax, and also the move for compensation for the head tax and issues around that as well. When you come to the collection, you'll see drawers everywhere, and you can pull out the drawers to get more material. So it's easy to, you can spend 10 minutes here, you could spend a couple of hours here if you wanted to read everything.
So do you mind talking a bit on the certificate?
Yeah, so as part of the collection, part of the story that's documented in the collection is the head tax. I mean, there's one head tax on display, but there's others also available in the collection itself, which you can view in the reference room. And the collection itself charts the story of the head tax, the repeal of the head tax, the Exclusion Act, and all of the historic steps that happened to the Chinese community in trying to bring their families here to join them, because after the railway construction completed, there were a lot of people that stayed in the province but weren't able to bring their families out here, or weren't able to bring wives or brides or children out here because of the head tax. So that story, again, is told in this collection as well.
So I have a limited understanding of, like, this specific part of history, but mm-hmm. I understand that this was intentional. The head tax was obviously, like, implemented because of racism.
Yeah.
And, I think it's interesting. This is just a statement, I suppose. I think it's interesting how they want Chinese labor, but not necessarily for the Chinese to, you know, be able to, like, bring their families over or make, like, a good life for themselves. It's more just about extracting labor.
Exactly. Yep, that's exactly it. And also, I'm not sure what people thought would happen to all the people that, all the Chinese labor that came after. I suppose they were hoping that they would go back to China. When you look at the history of the head tax as well, you see that the sum to be paid keeps increasing over time. Now, there were exemptions, some exemptions for business. Businessmen were able to bring their families out with greater ease. But for the most part, there were a lot of families that were separated with the Pacific in between them because of this, the inability or the extreme difficulty of bringing people from China over to Vancouver to join their husbands or their sons or their uncles or brothers as well. And you look at the cost of the head tax, I think it went up to as high as $500 and possibly more. And you think of $500 in today's dollars as a significant amount. You can imagine how prohibitive it was for someone who was a laborer who was probably, if they could find work, was getting paid less than European labor, to raise that kind of money to bring their family members out. It was probably close to impossible, if not very difficult. People would have to go into debt to do it, if it was possible to do it. So it really broke families apart to do this. Also, I think with the completion of the railway, you had a lot of men who couldn't find work. So I think that's how a lot of the Chinese benevolent societies started up, is to provide a way to care for and look after all of these men who did not have work or were trying to find work and to support them in some way.
Mm-hmm. And I also understand, correct me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. but also the laborers, when they were being collected from China, I think they were given the false impression that they would be paid better than they were. They would, like, there was just a lot of, like, false information around that, and, like, it was intentional. Do you know more about that?
Unfortunately, I don't know too much about that part of the story. I wouldn't doubt it mm-hmm. to be true, but I'm not personally a historian of this this era. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of the story based on the archival documents and the materials that I encounter and look after, but that part of the story I don't know as much about, the recruiting efforts. But I can imagine, I think there was a lot of misinformation that was given out, not just to the Chinese community, but to any immigrant mm-hmm. community, especially when they're talking about labor and exploitation. I think when you get into labor versus management or labor versus business owners, there's always going to be mistruths presented and incorrect information. I mean, just look at that in any context, let alone when you add racism into the picture as well, then you're going to get all of those problems exacerbated to a greater extent.
Mm-hmm. I'm also interested in learning more about the Chinese community, like after the completion of the Canadian Pacific Railway, and how Chinese communities sprung up and how they built a life.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of information in the Chung collection about early Chinatowns and Chinese communities, and some information about the businesses that built up and prominent business people that were part of that community. So that story is told as well, and how those communities built and how they thrived and the successes they had and the challenges they faced. So that story is very much prominent in the collection as well. The Vancouver Chinatown, just I think because we're in the city of Vancouver, is well represented as well. The businesses, one of the things that Dr. Chung was able to get from the Wing Sang Company is all of the records of the CPR purchases of people traveling back and forth between Vancouver and China. So you get ticket stubs and who bought tickets and where, which has been a great source of genealogical information for a lot of people in Vancouver, because they're able to see their family that traveled back and forth between China and Vancouver and get a lot of information there. It also shows, I think, the thriving community, how it kept getting bigger, there's more success, and certainly with the franchise in the late 1940s and the repeal of the Exclusion Act, that those communities were able to thrive and prosper.
To understand more about fashion, we asked CITR student executive and fashion expert Jonathan Q what fashion means to him.
Like, it's just aesthetically something that's so ostentatious. Typically. I mean, because of course, I mean, it's also, you know, I mean, when you say fashion, I think people are talking explicitly about consumerism, as opposed to someone who buys, like, you know, let's say, you know, someone buys a
If you really want to know more about fashion, come on down to CITR in the Student Union Building of UBC and pick up some of our merchandise à la mode. Nous avons t-shirts, sweatshirts, socks, and coffee mugs.
But it's also very aesthetically gripping.
To keep you styling in support of the station you love. Isn't that right, Jonathan?
Well, actually, is it? Because, I mean, you know, I was going to say because of the cultural vacuum that we exist within, but then, you know, really, fashion today is kind of derived from the European idea of couture, and that's been around for centuries.
All right, I'm gonna do it, Rom. I'm about to spit in this mic like freestyle elfin, you know?
Okay. Wait, hold on. Does this make sense?
No, but who cares? All right, let's go. Finally, we... You're not even gonna last. All right. Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival, fountain, just back from France, Montreal. What the
It's the script.
I couldn't even, what? Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival, fountain, okay, just back from France. What are you even
This band is really good, and I've been wanting to find out more about local music.
Yeah, I heard about it through CITR and Discorder.
What's that?
It's a radio station. You can review all the music that comes in and help out with touring bands, or just do some data entry to get started in their music department.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, you can just email volunteer@citr.ca and they can help you get into the station, or just come in whenever.
Well, I'll be there, so...
Welcome back to... On the Point on CITR 101.9 FM. We just listened to a piece by Isa on the Chung Collection, currently on display at the Irving K. Barber Learning Center on campus.
Given how multicultural and diverse Vancouver is, it's not surprising that it's often been at the center of many events with global consequences. In the last few months alone, the Lower Mainland has seen heated protests about Hong Kong, candlelight vigils for the Iranian plane crash victims, and the most recently an ongoing complicated extradition.
Yep.
Extradition.
Yep. That works.
Extradition. hearing for Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou. This Sunday, Vancouver's large South Asian community will be in the spotlight protesting the Indian government at the Indian consulate downtown. But why exactly is Vancouver's second largest minority demographic protesting the world's biggest democracy? To tell us more, here's Akshay, a member of CITR's News Collective and a graduate student of journalism.
Thank you for having me.
So Akshay, what is the protest on Sunday about?
So it's organized by a bunch of different organizations in the area, like Global Peace Society, and it's standing in solidarity with three different universities in India. It's on the 26th of January, Sunday, which is like India's Republic Day, which is when our constitution was sort of ratified. And all of these three universities, which I will come on to, have been attacked directly or indirectly by the Narendra Modi government in India, who's the current prime minister. And basically, the constitution proclaimed us to be a secular state, accepting of all religions. And the three universities were protesting a recent citizenship law, which made it seem anti-Muslim and non-secular.
Mm-hmm. So can you tell us more about this citizenship law?
All right. So the citizenship law is like, it's been amended, but most recent amendment is December 2019. And it had a sort of weird provision, which seems good at first glance, which is it was amended to provide an easier route to citizenship from refugees from other countries like Afghanistan, Pakistan, Bangladesh, who are all neighboring countries of India. But it had a specific exemption for Muslims. So only Hindus, Sikhs, Buddhists, Jains, whatever, any other religion, apart from Muslims, they get an easier way into citizenship in India, which you automatically, it just makes you think, okay, that's a little weird. But it's been combined with this thing called the National Register of Citizens, which basically, if you can't prove your citizenship, and a lot of Muslims, especially on the borders of India, can't, you get rendered stateless. So just over the past few months, over almost 200,000 people have been rendered stateless because of this. And almost exclusively, they've been Muslims. So that's what the universities are protesting against. And it's in sort of line with Modi's Hindu nationalist agenda.
So could you explain what that would mean and how it is different from Islamophobia?
Sure. So it's not, Islamophobia obviously ties into it, but Hindu nationalism is slightly different. So he and his party believe that India was constituted as a secular country, which I did mention, but they believe that the Hindu majority should have more rights because, you know, they're the majority, they're 70% of the country. And so the Citizen Amendment Act was sort of seen as a way of like pitting the Hindu majority against the Muslim minority again. Like there have been multiple incidents of this, but this is like the latest sort of flashpoint, really. And this also comes, we talked about this earlier on the show, about how he shut off the internet for India's only Muslim majority state, Kashmir. No internet for 5 months. It's like draconian. There's like so much military state there. So like, yeah, it's Hindu nationalism is almost exclusively now devoted to Islamophobia, but it's slightly more. So yeah, that's why the universities are protesting, really.
Mm-hmm. And so how has the government responded to these universities protesting?
So, I mean, it's been, again, pretty brutal crackdown. So mm-hmm. two universities, Jamia Millia Islamia and Aligarh Muslim University. You can tell by the names, you know, they're heavily affiliated with Muslim organizations. There was a big police crackdown. There was tear gas fired. Over 60 students were injured. And the police have been, like, very prompt with, like, you know, putting people in jail and all of that stuff. But in another attack at Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi, the attackers were affiliated with the BJP. They were part of this organization called ABVP. But the police didn't charge them, and they just stood by as the ABVP attacked the university and like beat up teachers and students. And it was like really bad scenes. But like obviously the police didn't do anything because the government obviously has a lot of control. So yeah, that's the protest on Sunday is just... It's protesting a lot of stuff, but this is the latest flashpoint. The university is just being held hostage, really.
Mm-hmm. And Vancouver obviously has like a big South Asian population, but I've noticed we haven't really heard much about this.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because you'd think it'd be bigger news. We heard a lot about China, but we really haven't heard too much about India. And the sort of reason is because the Canadian government has a vested interest in keeping India on side, because we're huge trading partners with India. And it would just be a huge diplomatic incident if we broke ranks and, you know, like condemned the Modi government. So both Justin Trudeau and BC Premier John Hogan haven't said anything about it really, because they're afraid of both offending not only the Indian government, but also the vocal Indian minority here, because they're very closely allied with the BJP. Jagmeet Singh is really the only federal leader to ever talk about this at any sort of level. And I think the protest on Sunday is trying to get the attention of these leaders to try to bring some attention to how bad the situation is in India. But we're going to have to see how that works out.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Akshay. And on the point, we'll be sending reporters to Sunday's protest, and we will hear more about it next week. United Islam Awareness Week is an annual cross-university event for raising awareness and spreading knowledge about Islam. At UBC, the event is organized by the Muslim Students Association, who have put on a series of lectures this week on campus featuring different guest speakers on topics about Muslims and Islam. The theme this year is Radical Islamic Honesty. UIAW, the acronym, the Muslim Students Association hopes to reach people unfamiliar with Islam and clarify aspects of their faith that people might be misinformed or uninformed about. So the interview with Rev Yu, a executive member of MSA, let's take a listen.
Cool.
We are working.
Yeah, I was not prepared. I am so sorry.
Zachary.
It wouldn't be
the
on
first
the point.
Time you do it. It's okay. You're doing great.
And here we go.
This is an interview for CITR with one of the event organizers for United Islam Awareness Week. And sitting here with me is...
My name's Rabia, and I'm in third year.
And what major are you?
Oh, I'm majoring in Community and Indigenous Forestry.
Okay, so what made you guys decide to organize United Islam Awareness Week?
Well, so first off, Islam Awareness Week is something that's been around that quite a few universities do, and essentially it's a campaign to really kind of clear up a lot of misconceptions about Islam and really share our narrative of what we believe and who we are. What's kind of different about like the United piece this year is we're actually doing it not just at UBC, but across university campuses all over Western Canada. So essentially we're doing it MRU in Calgary, U of S and U of R in Saskatchewan, and then we're doing it SFU in UBC, and we also had the Muslim Student Association from Langara do a booth on Monday as well. So the idea is... there's so many forces out there that talk about all the negative aspects of Islam and distort the message. So we thought, well, why don't we, as a united collective effort, share, you know, who we truly are kind of all across Canada and be able to kind of tell Canadians who Muslims are and what we actually believe.
Could you tell us why you think this week is important?
Sure, absolutely. So, I mean... First off, it's really hard to understand a people if you don't speak directly to them. And so, you know, I wouldn't want, you know, for example, if you're wanting to learn more about cheetahs, I'm not going to talk to an elephant expert. You know, you want to talk to the actual people. And I think something like this is so important because there's so much misinformation and false news out there, especially with the advent of the internet and social media. News gets shared so quickly, and especially a lot of incorrect facts. And really what a lot of these incorrect facts about Islam do is they stoke a lot of Islamophobia. And so now, not only is there, you know, negative rhetoric about Muslims, but there's actual violent action. So for example, actually January of 2017, Alexandre Bissonnette walked into a masjid or a mosque in Quebec, and he started shooting worshippers, and because of his anti-Muslim views. Moreover, we just actually experienced the shooting in New Zealand as well. There's a Muslim ban in the United States, and really kind of all across the globe, you have far-right presidents. You have Boris Johnson in the UK, Trump in the US, you have Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil. You have so many anti-Muslim leaders that are really kind of campaigning against Muslims. And so for us, it's really important that, you know, as a community and as a group, to avoid this marginalization, we want to share who we are and promote a greater understanding. We have such a diverse community in Canada that we want to be able to, you know, meet at a level where as a community we can understand each other and kind of clear up these things that divide us.
That's a really good answer.
Oh, thank you.
In your introduction, like your MC's introduction, yeah, she talked about how Islamic honesty is radical, and mm-hmm. she said that you guys can actually positively challenge the status quo. So what do you guys mean by that? And you also mentioned the posters across campus, mm-hmm. and like, oh, you could think that we're promoting ISIS, or you can come to our events and see what we're talking about.
Yeah, so absolutely.
Could you elaborate on that?
Absolutely. So, I mean, this portion is really about reclaiming the narrative. So taking these kind of buzzwords that are really used to other Muslims and to fearmonger, we want to turn them into something positive. So something like the word radical, we often hear it in the context when it comes to Muslim about radicalizing Muslims and how, you know, there's homegrown terrorism because Muslims are learning more about the religion and becoming radicalized. We hate the West. And so for us, we kind of want to turn that on its head and be like, okay, if we want to talk about something radical, let's talk about radical honesty. Is it actually true that Muslims all hate the West and, you know, want to blow everyone up? Let's be radical and in that, tell the truth.
So how do you think this lecture in particular helped mm-hmm. towards that?
Sure. Well, I mean, a lot of the topics that we picked are based around the basic tenets of faith in our religion, as well as things that often have misconceptions. So Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is a very important figure for Muslims, as we take him as, you know, the walking representation of our purpose in life and how to live a life as a Muslim. And so what often kind of gets sparked in the news is when people are often disrespectful to the Prophet, there's often a lot of backlash, and that can be verbal backlash, and also there can be, you know, kind of physical backlash as well. So often these things are portrayed to show, well, Muslims are so violent, if you say anything about their Prophet, they're going to start, you know, reacting with violence. And for us, this is a way to kind of first give the context of why it is so incredibly and deeply hurtful to malign such a beloved figure to us, and also to talk about, well, there's a reason why people have such strong emotional responses, and also, you know, who does he actually mean to us, and how does he actually factor into, you know, Muslims' practice. Often we hear so much about Jesus, who also is a prophet in Islam, Moses, Adam, Abraham, all these prophets that are part of Abrahamic faith, but people often don't recognize that we believe in them as well, but also we place a special emphasis on Prophet Muhammad as kind of completing the seal of prophets.
So would you say that the target audience for this this week, this awareness week, who would you say they were?
Sure. I mean, the target audience, you know, to be broad, it is for everybody. Everybody in the Lower Mainland and really across Western Canada. But we are particularly hoping to attract those who actually don't know anything about Islam or have doubts or confused or have misconceptions about what Muslims believe. And so our hope is really to actually clarify a lot of things and to really kind of share the knowledge and the truth. So, I mean, for people who are already Muslim, it's nice to come and kind of learn a bit more. But for those who don't know anything about Islam or might have a negative perception, it's even more important because you hear directly from the source and you might even learn a thing or two and kind of change your worldview of what you thought.
So, final question. What do you think the attendees of these lectures will take away from it?
Well, I mean, I think whatever anyone takes away, it's up to them. It's different for each person. But I hope, in general, what attendees take away is just, honestly, a greater understanding of Islam and Muslims. Really just getting to know who we truly are. And I know that's a bit broad. And, you know, different parts will kind of affect different parts of what you know and different things that you're into. But really, we just want people to walk away saying, hey, I actually know another fact about Islam. I actually know a little bit more. So next time it's brought up in a conversation or you see something on the news, something negative, you can kind of critically think and say, well, actually, this is actually the truth about what that is. And I think, you know, you can basically critically analyze media about Muslims and kind of have a greater understanding of people of your community.
Okay, thank you so much. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
recent climate protests and UBC C350's push for UBC to divest from fossil fuels both prominently talked about the use of fossil fuels and emissions. One of the areas we don't think about a lot when it comes to fossil fuel emissions is how we dispose of our dead, emissions from the funeral industry. There were more than 10 million kilograms of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere from British Columbians cremating their dead in 2017. That's not something to cough at. That's equivalent to more than 2,000 homes' yearly energy usage. Given that BC has a reputation for being a very green province, it is very surprising we don't have a cleaner method of body disposal. In fact, BC is one of the provinces that doesn't use aquamation, a system of body disposal that uses liquid alkali instead of fossil fuels to decompose the body and has zero emissions. Akshay published a story for the Thunderbird in November, which examines aquamation and the fight for its legalization here in BC. Thanks for joining us, Akshay.
Again. Yes, it's me.
Could you start out by telling us what exactly aquamation is?
Actually, can I cut you guys off for a second? Yep. For our listeners out there, this is a little bit of a graphic warning. If you are squeamish at these kind of things, I would recommend tuning out for the next few minutes and then maybe coming back in like 5-10 minutes or so.
Sure.
Sorry, I just wanted to add, we're also going to talk about like death, and so if that's something you're uncomfortable with, you might want to like turn us down for a bit.
Sure. All right. With all of that out of the way, so I was just asked what aquamation is. So it's basically the process of dissolving the body using alkali, as Adeline just said. It's also called biocremation, alkaline hydrolysis. And the analogy I'd use is, if you can imagine a morgue in like a TV cop drama. It's a machine just similar to that. And they use alkali, so sodium hydroxide and potassium hydroxide, and they mix it with water. And that releases a lot of heat, and that just, essentially it melts the body. And the bones, fillings, implants, all of that stuff is left behind. And that's sort of an advantage over cremation, because otherwise they would be just sent into the atmosphere, and that releases a lot of mercury, like radioactive compounds, all that sort of harmful stuff. But none of that happens with aquamation. So yeah, it's there seems to be few downsides.
Interesting. So how safe is the liquidized body?
Well, it contains no DNA or like organic matter, because it sort of gets dissolved into the liquid that they use. It's been, so the final liquid is being like described as like a weak cup of coffee by various sources. And it also fits into a teacup appropriately. It's very small, really. And it can be used to fertilize plants. That's what a lot of people I spoke to said people did. But it normally goes into the water supply, and that reduces the carbon footprint as well, because it keeps going into the water cycle, it gets reused. So I talked to Derek Tremblay, who learns Le Sueur in Granby, Quebec, and he offers aquamation. And he talked about how the treated water is safe and how it goes into the water supply. So, yeah.
Let's take a listen.
Now, people have some misunderstanding of what's aquamation, thinking, oh, we're drinking again that water.
Yeah.
And we're saying in Granby you don't, because it goes to the sewers, but it goes to the, the factory, not the factory, the, in French, Usine Service des Eaux Usées.
Processing plant,
the water is
maybe?
Treated. I'm sorry?
Processing plant, maybe?
Yes, processing plant.
Yeah.
And it goes back to the river. So, one, we don't drink that water. Yeah. Two, I always say to people, when they're giving me that argument, I said, well, in Granby, there's like 65,000 people.
Yeah.
These people go to the toilet.
Yeah.
Are you drinking that water?
Not really, no.
And they look at me and they say, no. Exactly the same thing for the aquamation.
Yeah.
We're talking here about 1% a day. We're not talking about, because if we're talking about 60,000 people, at least they go to the toilet at least once a day.
Yeah.
So multiply that at least for two, and whatever they're going to put in the toilet. So, no, and the residue of the aquamation has to go somewhere.
Yeah.
So that go to the treatment services.
Right.
So that's why, and they're using basically the same chemical products, so it will not affect the environment directly.
That's how aquamation works. It's obviously legal in Quebec, but where else is it legal?
So it's currently legal in Quebec, obviously, Ontario and Saskatchewan. Saskatchewan was the first province to legalize it back in 2011, and 17 US states have also legalized it. Three of them did it last year, so that was 2019. And also, it's also legal across the world in the UK, Germany, Australia, all of that stuff.
And how popular is it in the places that it is legal? Is that related to how expensive it is?
So I couldn't get concrete figures, but I did speak to a lot of funeral directors in the places where it is legal in Canada. And they all said it's either the same price as cremation or slightly lesser. Well, obviously, since it's new technology, there's an initial setup cost. But given that it's way easier to perform than cremation because, you know, you don't have to burn the body, that money can be made back pretty quickly. And it's also proven to be very popular in the places where it is legal. So I talked to Kelly Chatterton in Newcastle Funeral Home in Ontario, and she spoke about how popular it is.
I see that it's been very popular with our families, for sure.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah, most of our families are going that way.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, so it's good. We're kind of hoping it does become the new normal for the funeral industry.
So far, there doesn't seem to be too many downsides to it. So why isn't it legal in BC then?
Well, the funeral directors I spoke to said it's a combination of three things. Not enough people know about it. Well, as you can see, you know, it's not really a new technology. And as a result, since people don't know about it, there isn't enough political will. And then the funeral industry itself is very slow to change. So I spoke to the first guy who ever offered it in Canada. His name is Drew Gray, Saskatchewan. And he said if it was legalized, it would be the end of flame-based cremation. So like he said, it's the last vestige of an old-fashioned industry, but they refused to move on. And then I spoke to another funeral director in Saskatchewan, Norman Fiss. And he just told me how like sort of closed-minded the funeral industry is.
Part of it is the funeral profession itself.
Yeah.
Is so parochial that they're scared.
Yeah.
They're worried that if they start doing it, people will think they're gross and disgusting and stop going to them.
Right. So we've heard all about aquamation from various angles. How far away from it? How far away is it from getting legalized in BC? And is there a bill in the House about it?
Well, no, not at all, really. The BC legislature has never really debated the issue of cremation emissions, aquamation, anything. I mean, it's kind of weird because there's an NDP Green coalition, so you sort of think this would be like a slam dunk, right? This would be like the easiest legislation to pass, but it really hasn't. There's one man who's fighting to get it legal in BC. His name is Chris Benish. He runs a green burial business in Victoria. So like, that's the only form of like it's burial, but without like any of the trappings. So like, it's sort of eco-friendly, but not really. I mean, not to the same extent as aquamation is, because that's brings things back into the cycle. So he's been pretty much fighting a lone battle. He's been like turned down by MLAs, Andrew Weaver, formerly of the Green Party, for example. And I talked to him about like his next steps and what he wants to do. So yeah.
You know, I would need to find interested organizations that would help fund a campaign to educate people. To get the word out, it's hard to do with, you know, one man show with,
yeah,
you know, limited budget, right? But if you have a larger organization behind you that would support it, then maybe they can take it. So I've taken this to the Provincial Chamber of Commerce, and I've taken it to the CFIB, which is the Canadian Federation of Independent Business.
Yeah.
And they both sent letters to the minister on my behalf as well, saying that, you know, we support this as an organization. But at the end of the day, I mean, and I'm very pleased that they've given me some letters of support, but at the end of the day, they're not sending any cash, and that doesn't pay for any means of being able to afford a lobby. Now, the corporation that I'm up against, if they try to block it, they have a budget bigger than most countries. They're a multi-billion dollar corporation.
Wow. Oh, wow.
You know, so they want to stop or at least put a lot of money toward it. They certainly have the means to do it, right?
If you're interested, check out a story titled Body Disposal Not a Burning Issue in BC at thethunderbird.ca. And who knows, in a few years, cremation might be a thing of the past.
So that brings us to the end of our show. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for Undercover Current Affairs.